transmitting live from the heart of Times Square on 99.5 FM, WBAI New York, Pacifica Radio for the Tri-State area. This is Trump Watch, a weekly series investigating the actions of and reactions to President Donald J. Trump and his administration. I'm your host, Jesse Lent.
When you look at like NASA, or you look at the Energy Department, and what your own government, your own scientists have said about it, they said it's sort of indisputable that humans have contributed to global warming in big ways.
Well, I think we've certainly contributed. I mean, there's certain pollutants that go up, and there are certain things that happen, certain things we do that if we weren't here, certainly...
They say the overwhelming cause for the last 50
years. Well, I don't necessarily agree.
But it doesn't seem like in the report that there's that much of a may to it. Like, it's your government, right? It's your scientists. They work for you.
Well,
it's your
that's
company.
That's okay.
Your country.
That's okay. And I want everybody to report whatever they want. But ultimately, I'm the one that makes that final decision. I can also give you reports where people very much dispute that. You know, you do have scientists that very much dispute it. I want to make sure that we have the cleanest air.
But there really aren't. And, about that one, there really aren't that many
but
scientists.
But, Jim, I want to make sure, here's what I want. So you have different views on this, and is there climate change? Yeah. Will it go back like this? I mean, will it change back? Probably. That's what I think.
That was President Trump speaking to Jim VandeHei and Jonathan Swift of Axios back in November on the television show Axios on HBO. From the U.S. pledging to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord to a 30% tax on imported solar panels, the last 32 months have shown us exactly what it means to have a president who is, at the very least, skeptical about the effects of climate change. This, as a vast majority of the scientific community, including experts in President Trump's own administration, tell us the warming of the planet will bring catastrophic consequences in the years ahead, consequences we're already starting to see. Hello and welcome to Trump Watch. There's one aspect of the global warming debate that often gets left out of the discussion: exactly what it will mean for the affordable housing crisis and homelessness in America. Here to help examine the link between global warming and homelessness is Teresa Wiltz, a reporter for Stateline, a blog published by the Pew Charitable Trusts, whose latest article, Climate Change is Making the Affordable Housing Crunch Worse, was published on Friday. Hello, Teresa. Welcome to Trump Watch. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
As we broadcast this interview live tonight on Wednesday, Hurricane Dorian is reportedly headed for Georgia and the Carolinas, leaving behind a trail of destruction in Florida and the Bahamas. We, of course, send our deepest sympathies to anyone in Dorian's path who might be listening, by the off chance that they are, or anyone with loved ones in that area. But Teresa, what are some of the ways that climate change can affect a storm like Dorian?
Well, I'm not a climate reporter. I'm a housing reporter, so I can just talk to you about, you know, how it affects housing, and that it, you know, in many ways what happens is it creates increased supply and increased demand and decreased supply. So, and the people that tend to get hit really hard are low-income renters. So, and that's because often affordable housing, there's an affordable housing crunch anyway. There's something like 7 million, short of something like 7 million affordable housing units around the country, according to the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. So there's already a dearth of affordable housing. And the affordable housing that exists is often built in floodplains. So they're going to be much, much more susceptible to flooding, or they're going to be made of, cheaper materials. So they're built, affordable housing is built where the land is cheaper. So flood zone, land's going to be much cheaper. And they're going to be built with, you know, generally inferior materials that aren't going to be able to withstand, you know, something like a Hurricane Dorian. So, and then when you put on top of that, that, you know, reimbursement, FEMA's reimbursing people, often low-income people don't have the ability to, like FEMA might put them up in temporary housing in a hotel or a motel, but if you're low-income, you might not have the credit card for the security deposit. So it kind of hits low-income people from a variety of different angles and just makes them much more vulnerable.
Yes, there was a lot to unpack there, and I hope we can get to all of it in the next 20 minutes. But are there any programs, either at the local or national level, aiming to simply change where affordable housing is built, making it built on safer ground rather than in these flood zones, as you mentioned?
I mean, there's some, you know, work on like individual, you know, city by city, state by state kind of thing. So, for example, in North Carolina, they're kind of looking into, you know, if we can't, you know, can we elevate these buildings so that if they're strong enough to be elevated and cranked up so that then the water would flow, I guess, underneath it, or building, you know, doing things to flood-proof a building and to create, like, basically, I guess, like a moat so the water would flow around it rather than through it. And then, you know, building affordable housing and mixed use in a mixed income neighborhood where located in a flood zone. So there, you know, but it's happening more on an individual basis around the country. There's not one set program.
And presumably, anytime you start talking about moving low-income housing into more affluent neighborhoods, you get the NIMBYism, the not-in-my-backyard sentiment that seems to play such a large part in this.
Exactly, exactly. And sometimes it happens in communities that are, you know, the most liberal communities, like in California and the Bay Area. There are people that want to keep intact the character and the quaintness of their neighborhoods, and they want single family homes, they don't want a multifamily, you know, unit built in their neighborhood. So
you have a line graph in your article that shows how the number of weather or climate disasters in the U.S. costing $1 billion or more has increased considerably since 1980. What kind of effect has that increase had on housing nationwide?
You know, there's already a housing shortage, and then disasters are creating even more of a housing shortage. And so people that are homeowners that are more well off might be grabbing for a rental unit while they're waiting for their home to be rebuilt. So you'll see rents skyrocket. I mean, Hurricane Katrina was a really good example of that. That's kind of like ground zero for, you know, climate change and affordable housing colliding. And rents just increased dramatically after Katrina. I mean, New Orleans kind of turned into, in many ways, a boutique city, and you've seen poorer people kind of pushed out into the outskirts of the city. And, you know, rents are much more expensive. Buying a house is much more expensive.
And I am obviously, or obvious to anyone, any regular listener of this program, far from a climate scientist myself. But from what I understand, this, or would just assume, this churning effect where a superstorm like Dorian or Katrina lingers in one area would be particularly devastating to the housing infrastructure there.
I mean, the longer it lingers, the more damage it can wreck, right? I mean, so if it's the winds aren't passing and it's just staying in one place and the storm is growing and increasing in size and intensity, there's just going to be a lot more devastation.
You touched on FEMA briefly. This is, of course, one of the major ways the federal government helps people whose home or apartment has been destroyed in a natural disaster. This is the Federal Emergency Management Agency. You report that President Trump announced last week he would divert $271 million in funding from the Department of Homeland Security, including from FEMA's Disaster Relief Fund, to pay for immigration courts and Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention centers. Will that have any observable effect on the way that FEMA operates, in your view?
I only assume so. I mean, they're going to have fewer funds to go around. There's already, you know, shortages of funding all around. So I can't see that it would be particularly helpful for people trying to rebuild.
I realize this is a bit outside of the scope of this specific article, but as a housing reporter, can you describe the link between affordable housing and homelessness in America?
Well, homelessness is on the increase. And, you know, there's a myth about homelessness that it's, you know, the people that you see talking to themselves, pushing, you know, shopping cart around, that's what homelessness is. But, I mean, homelessness is not having a fixed address. And you're seeing, I live in D.C., I used to live in New York. They're just much more, I just see much more visible evidence of people, you know, living on the street. And a lot of the people are working, and a lot of them are families. And they might, if they're not living on the street, they might be sleeping in their car, or they might be doubling up on a friend's couch, or, you know, renting a motel room week to week. So housing has become much more expensive. In no city in the U.S., I think this is data compiled by the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, has can someone who's living on earning a minimum wage can survive, you know, can afford an apartment in no city in the country. So there's definitely a shortage of affordable housing. And if you can't afford to have a home, then what are you going to do? You're going to end up on the streets or couch surfing.
Do we have any sense of how many homeless people in the country are people that were displaced by a natural disaster?
It's hard to get that statistic. It's just not really tracked very well. So it's hard to say.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I want to get into some of the specific data in your article now, since mm-hmm. this is really interesting stuff. You looked at the FEMA data for relief funds in Puerto Rico following Hurricanes Irma and Maria. Of the over 900,000 applicants who reported their incomes, 79.2% reported making less than $30,000 a year. More than half of the applicants reported incomes of less than $15,000 a year. What can Puerto Rico tell us about the way that those more extreme climate disasters disproportionately affect low-income residents?
There are people in Puerto Rico that are still, you know, they're still blue tarps on their, you know, cover instead of a roof on their homes. I think those numbers are pretty stark. And I think it's just a real demonstration of how if you are lower income, you've got fewer resources and you're just going to be much more vulnerable to extreme weather events. You know, you're going to be much less likely to be able to evacuate. You're going to be much less likely to be able to rebuild. If you're a renter, you're going to be basically at the whims of your landlord, who, you know, may or may not may choose to rebuild or may decide it's not worth it. It's too expensive to rebuild and decide to just demolish and move on.
And to just bear down on that a little bit, I mean, as it's often documented in certainly in cities like New York, that low income people tend to live further away from their jobs. I would assume that's a factor in the evacuation, right? Because certain people might be asked to evacuate, but their job might be in a non-evacuation zone. So if they evacuate, they could lose their job, not to mention just people not having the means to rent a hotel room or rent a car or even buy a train ticket, right?
Definitely. And, you know, you also have more and more today, more and more poor people are living in the suburbs and the exurbs and actually living in the city. So there's much more, less access to transportation and more isolation.
FEMA has had a reputation for being late or negligent ever since what many perceived as the botched federal response to Hurricane Katrina. In its impact on Louisiana and the surrounding areas back in 2005, as you mentioned. Do you believe the agency has improved its disaster response capabilities in the nearly 15 years since then?
You know, I can't speak to that, since I'm not a climate reporter. And, you know, I've, been focusing mainly on housing issues instead. But one of the complaints that I have heard from people like Marty Blaney in North Carolina and some other people is just that it takes a long time to get reimbursed. So, he is the head of the New Bern Housing Authority in New Bern, North Carolina. And his property was, half of his public housing stock got wiped out by Hurricane Florence. So, and actually, they decided that they're going to have to demolish properties. They're not fixable. So.
Right. This is a big part of this issue as well, right? That many of these properties, as we just touched on briefly earlier, are not built very well of their low-income housing. So the odds of them even having any salvageable sections of the housing or even a foundation, I'm not a builder, but these increase exponentially, right, if you're talking the majority of affordable housing in America.
Yeah, or if it's public housing, it might have been well-built, you know, decades and decades ago in the 1930s, but these are buildings that are in, you know, that are deteriorating and aging rapidly. Congress has not appropriated funds to rehabilitate public housing. So it's already, you've already got these old buildings. And then if, you know, a hurricane disaster comes, then they're going to be that much more vulnerable because they're already not in good shape because they're old.
Back in June, President Trump issued an executive order designed, according to a White House press release, to, quote, tear down red tape in order to build more affordable housing. Do you know anything about this executive order, and do you expect it to lead to any substantial policy changes?
Tear down, I'm not sure which one that one is.
I guess more broadly then, are there any initiatives the Trump administration has enacted that you believe have been effective in possibly confronting this problem?
One solution that they're leaning in on is something that started with the Obama administration, which was to kind of privatize public housing. And because there has these buildings, this housing stock is, public housing stock is aging rapidly, and it's called the RAD program, rental, and that's basically to privatize public housing and put it in the hands so that private managers can tap into equity and other, it makes the financing much more flexible for them. So that's something they're leaning in on and as a way to rehabilitate these old buildings. They've done some initiatives with young people and trying to end homelessness among the youth. But their vision seems to be more privatizing public housing rather than building new public housing.
This might be an impossible question to answer, but one pattern I've noticed personally with a lot of these disasters, whether it's post-Katrina New Orleans or even post-Sandy New York and New Jersey, there seems to be this kind of endless delay in getting federal funds out to the people who are affected. Is there anything you can explain to our listeners about where those delays come from and why, in all the years that we've been doing federal assistance, giving federal assistance to hurricanes, we still can't seem to get this worked out?
I'm not comfortable commenting about that. You know, there's just a lot of bureaucratic red tape, and there's a lot of regulations and rules, and that just creates a lot of hurdles when it comes to rebuilding.
Do you have any sense of how much President Trump's refusal to acknowledge the dangers of climate change or enact any substantial protections over the 4 years or potentially 8 years that he's in the presidency could affect this issue of low-income housing being washed away by rising seas and other severe climate incidents, fires, I assume, as well as hurricanes and other types of extreme weather?
I mean, you know, I can just point to the experts who, you know, for example, the new report by Harvard University's Joint Center for Housing Studies, and they've said that climate change is, you know, the damage done by increasing and frequent storms is creating an urgent housing challenge for the nation. So, and other housing experts and scientists, you know, know, climate scientists think that this, you know, as the storms increase in frequency, it will put affordable housing at further risk.
Now, we've been talking about the failure for the federal government, to be able to address some of these affordable housing issues in the face of natural disasters. But lest there be listeners out there thinking, well, clearly FEMA has its problems here. The states should take over and handle their own disaster relief. You report that the states have had trouble executing those kinds of problems as well. Is there any explainable reason why that is?
Lack of funding, lack of capacity, lack of staff. I mean, states are still kind of reeling from the Great Recession, and many of them, you know, had great big staffing cut slashing, and so they just don't have the capacity to do it. I mean, in Texas in particular, they had a lot of trouble trying to implement these housing trust funds.
Now, is that because the federal government hasn't offered the funds? Or I know that in some cases like these, senators or other state lawmakers refuse the funds.
That I don't know.
Yeah,
that's
yeah, sure, question. Sure. So for a variety of reasons. In looking at this, this maddening issue, are there any solutions that have come into your mind? I mean, is it just simply an issue of getting more money out there to the people who need it with less of a delay?
I think that would be helpful. I think some of the other issues have been, bear with me a second. money always helps. Fewer roadblocks help. And
this is, again, the red tape issue, that if we could make it easier for people to get this funding, that then they would that this would be a huge part towards solving the problem, right?
Yes, definitely.
I
mean, you know, increasing housing affordability and ensuring that housing stock is built, you know, to withstand disasters.
Is there a way to, I guess what I'm trying to think of how to phrase this, excuse me, but if in this presidency, if we see this sort of, this housing crisis increase, is this something that can be reversed by the next president? This is the proverbial question with a show about Trump, but how many of these housing decisions, as things get built, and once you decide what material to build something out of, obviously that's as long as the structure lasts. How much of this do you think is permanent?
Well, housing just takes a long time. So I don't know about permanent. I mean, policies can always be changed, but, you know, it takes a long time to get housing built and up and running. And so I think these are effects that will likely be with us for quite some time.
And in the last minute or so that we have here, you know, this is one of those issues where it involves so many large, potentially frightening government agencies. I think it's very overwhelming for the average person. Is there an activist aspect as well to this? I mean, obviously, housing activism is huge in this country. But have you observed ways that the general public is getting involved in this fight?
No, I haven't. I can't say that I have.
And so this is really just being fought along government lines?
For the moment.
So what else are you looking at right now? What other stories are on the horizon? I mean, the housing crisis is such a large issue. Is there anything that you could give us a preview of?
Right now I'm looking into homelessness and seriously mentally ill people, and trying to some programs that are trying to force them into treatment so that they can stabilize and get housing. So that's one thing I'm looking at the moment.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, too.
I've been speaking to Teresa Wiltz, a reporter for Stateline, a blog published by the Pew Charitable Trusts, whose recent article, Climate Change is Making the Affordable Housing Crunch Worse, which combines the results of several recent studies. You're listening to Trump Watch. My name is Jesse Lent. And that's all for this week. Reggie Johnson engineered this program live. You can hear all 126 episodes of Trump Watch with Jesse Lent, 127 episodes of Trump Watch with Jesse Lent, at soundcloud.com/TrumpWatchWBAI or wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again next week when we'll break down a different aspect of the Donald Trump administration. Until then, I'm your host, Jesse Lent. Talk to you next time.